Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for a weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be with you. Relieved Friday.
Yeah, you must be relieved because as big as we all thought the Conference of Presidents 50th annual gala would be, and believe me, we discussed it here, everyone understood the magnitude of the event and what type of Jewish leadership would be there, and other leadership as well would be there. But as a surprise to the entire crowd at the wall-to-wall Waldorf Astoria on Tuesday night, George W. Bush, I remind you, at one time he was president of the United States. You remember that era, Malcolm, don't you?
I recall it vaguely, yeah.
And he brought the house down. I said to myself, and it's no secret that you were kind enough to tell me minutes before the event that he was expected, even though it was kept a secret essentially until he walked onto the stage. And I said to myself, this is the Conference of Presidents. It's a very diverse group. There are going to be people in that audience who are not exactly thrilled with George Bush's 8 years in office. And yet, you have to admit, Mr. Honlein, when he walked in and when he spoke, he brought the house down.
It was exactly what we had hoped would be. First of all, we started with a message from President Obama, and the theme of the evening was strength through unity. And I want to thank you very much for your important role in the event.
Thank you.
And we tried to do everything that was a matchup. We had Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations, who people, right when you hear UN, people shut off or are skeptical. The truth is that he has done a good job giving, and he has been a friend in quiet ways, effective ways. But more importantly, was the consistently throughout the theme, because the strength of the conference is the fact that we bring together 50 organizations and that we have to put aside differences. And today we see more and more how within our own community, let alone in the general world, it's differences, it's what divides people. That's the only thing anybody is interested in talking about. And here we had a chance to portray the opposite. So starting with a message from Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and hearing from, as varied people as the opposition, a former deputy prime minister of Iran and the head of the Egyptian COPS, representative of the Egyptian COPS, and of the head of the Moroccan Jewish community, the ambassador of Russia, the ambassadors of John Bolton and the ambassador of Israel, and all very brief, and everybody stuck to the time. So
yeah, having, that was miraculous. That's
and
a
having a former president who said to me that he did not want it to be a political event. I said, that's exactly, we're not partisan. This is a political, but it's not partisan. And that conference itself is bipartisan throughout all its activities, because that's the only way we can function and be effective for the Jewish community and to accomplish what we have. And as you said, I was worried, to be very honest, both when President Obama's video came up, there was very respectful response to it, the same with Bibi, same with everybody, and the explosion when he came in. And people at first, I think, didn't get it when there was the announcement was made.
Right.
And then he came on the stage and people saw it was really him. As you said, there wasn't we have the pictures. There's not a person sitting in their seat.
Right.
And everybody stayed. It was literally almost nobody. The hotel set us in. It was a dinner where everybody literally stayed.
I was shocked that there were about 100 people still hanging out at 10 p.m.
11.
Yeah.
No, seriously.
It's unbelievable.
100 still there. People did not leave. And we finished early. But the and then Cantor Helfgott's renditions of the anthems with everybody up there, including yourself, I thought was really the pièce de résistance people were.
Well, I got a couple of comments, and because of the timing, this is the day to talk about it for a minute. The first is that, look, the room was filled with a lot of leadership, a lot of very involved people. And that might be, nothing against those who are only semi-involved, but I think you get my point that people who take an active role in the community, no matter what their political position or feelings might be, understand what respect is about, and understand if the president speaks, whether it's via video or live, or a former president, the same. There's a certain protocol, a certain etiquette. In fact, it was pointed out by many during the evening how when you represent and your chairman represents the conference, and of course when the group is gathered with world leaders, there is a mutual respect. I think that was basically Ban Ki-moon's point, or at least one of his points during his speech, that, you know, at least you approach us with proper covet and with the right temperament, so to speak. That's the first thing.
That was exactly what President Bush said, actually, in his remarks as well. Said that even when we had differences, mostly he and I, that we respected the office and you were effective in making your presentations. And it's the argument I make all the time on the show, you know, when people say to us, and say to me after show, but just tell us how to vote, or tell us simple answers, you know, to things. And the world is a complex place, and sometimes things are not what they seem on the surface, and sometimes we criticize it because of a decision we make, but it's because of things that go on behind the scene that people don't know, and you can't say, because that will mean that the outcome won't be what we want, and it's more important for that than sometimes, you know, to in a popularity context, or have everybody know exactly the detail, which would upset the possibility. When the Iran 13 were released, and I stopped all the demonstrations, and some one or two people were critical at the time.
Well, more than that.
They didn't understand that we had a deal that said that we would not rub their face in it, and that the next time, chas v'shalom, something happens, we have the credibility that they will know we deliver what we say if they deliver.
Right. And remember, you didn't stop people from demonstrating independently. You just did not want the conference, holding an event when you gave your word to do something differently.
And we had the biggest demonstrations. I organized
Correct.
The demonstrations. It's just that you got to know when to hold them and when to fold them.
Right, as they say. And the other point is, and again, maybe next time you're in the studio, we could explore this further because it's so fascinating. You mentioned the job that you and your predecessors and Bob Sugarman and his predecessors have had to unite all the groups that are part of the Conference of Presidents. And we joke about this a lot, both privately and publicly. But it is an impossible task. I mean, essentially, it is impossible. And usually one would think it's impossible to reach a consensus. And we know that not everybody's the same. People know your background. People know, the type of life you lead. It may be completely different from others who are involved in the same causes and, you know, would like to see results in the same way. But the bottom line is there has to be some type of unifying factor, and it's miraculous that it can be done, but people have to realize that it's not just one opinion that goes into all this. It's more than 50 that go into it.
That's right. And it's not to water down your principles or the individual identity of organizations, but how you can get them to focus on what the objectives are. And that, in fact, in 99% of the cases, we have a common objective and can find common ground on which to build then that consensus. But we forget, got to mention the stars of the evening.
Your grandchildren. And I'm regretful. I was in conversation with the director the entire time that they were speaking, so I never even saw your grandchildren's routine. I hope there's a good video of it.
There's a great video of it.
So I must see that. But I know they were very cute, and I know at the end they actually got the name of the Conference of Presidents and your title out properly.
Right.
So I regretted not seeing the entire thing, but I hope to see it, and it was, as you say, very entertaining and inspiring. Hey, it's all about the children and grandchildren, isn't it, Malcolm? Everybody in that room has got to realize it's all about the children and grandchildren.
And many people were very moved and said, talked to us about it in ways that was they were amazing. Anyway, my grandson Mayer's speech was which he did himself.
Oh, he was! I told him he was superb. He was superb. Those were his own words, huh?
That's what it's all about. It's about the future and our responsibility to our children and grandchildren. That's why we do what we do, and we have to always look ahead to them and our responsibility to our grandparents and our grandchildren.
Yeah, and look
at with the developments these days, how important it is.
Right, and just look at where we are now in the Torah reading. We talk about all about the children and grandchildren. If anybody understood it, our forefathers and foremothers certainly did. All right, a lot to talk about this week. By the way, let me start with this only to give you an opportunity to remind everybody how effective their own leadership can be, even if they don't hold a special title. Charlotte Whale, who I know you knew, died this week at the age of 93. A short, petite woman who was a ball of fire, involved in every cause, and very passionate about so many things happening in the Jewish world. So, number one, we remember her, and I'm sure that those who knew her are glad that we again are mentioning her on the air as we did earlier in the week. But, Malcolm, I am sure she's one of the people who has taught you over the years that anybody of any small stature, quote-unquote, can make such a difference when they make their voice heard.
She taught, and more importantly, she lectured me regularly. She was an amazing woman. She would write letters all the time. She would listen to the show, by the way, regularly, and she would write me about things, issues, or where she had some concerns about things that I may have said or not. Sometimes she didn't get it exactly right, but she was amazingly committed. I knew her for decades, from Soviet Jewry. She used to come out for the demonstrations back in the 70s.
Wow.
A remarkable woman, and I was concerned that I hadn't heard from her for the last couple of months, Baruch Dayanemis, I'm sorry to hear that news.
And again, an opportunity to remind everybody that no matter how small the punches that they pack, everybody out there can make a difference.
Absolutely right.
All right, a lot of news to get to, obviously. Is, in fact, the White House going to ease sanctions with a slow release of assets in regard to Iran in order to reward them for what they've agreed to so far in the nuclear deal?
It's too early to tell. There are obviously talks going on. Many officials have said that we're not ready yet for a deal. We have not reached any conclusion. Some have said it's not close. Others have said that the Iranians have put forward some proposals, and there were reports that the Iranians offered a freeze on current enrichment for a period of time. There are reports that there was an offer and to reduce its stockpile for lifting all sanctions. That's a non-starter. And people have to understand, with the new centrifuges, some of the old formula that are now being regurgitated but are no longer relevant because of new centrifuges. What we used to talk about, 3.5%, then 5%, and then you would go to 20%, and then you would have to go to 90%. Today you can leapfrog from 5% to right away going into the 90%. It's much faster. It's a more efficient system with the new centrifuges. So these rules don't really hold, and there's going to be a meeting in Geneva. We're looking to Congress to introduce new sanctions and to continue the sanctions that exist, but we do know that they are considering all sorts of options about outreach and discussions. There are talks of Britain reestablishing diplomatic relations. This is all a mistake because they have done nothing to deserve
right.
it. And the Arab countries, as you know, are equally upset as Israel is by this appearance of softening the position or offering access to billions of dollars of frozen assets.
I mean, every week there's a different attitude. One week they're tough, and the next week, you know, they're ready to give rewards to Iran. And who's behind it, by the way? Is it exclusively the White House? Is Russia pressuring them? I mean, who's behind the effort to give this gesture to Iran?
Well, I don't know that there's pressure, and I don't know that we've given in. As far as I can see, we haven't yet.
But just that they're considering it.
Pardon me?
Just that they're considering it. I even hear it in your voice that you're frustrated they're even considering it.
Well, I am obviously very concerned. You know, 70% of Israelis are not convinced that the U.S. will resolve, and 77% believe Bibi is right. And Bibi this week said that the British and French spoke to both the leaders. Said that you shouldn't ease it until they dismantle.
Right.
Kerry has said this week, we're not going to, you know, dismantle the sanctions. Congress, I think, will be very strong about it, although the administration obviously can move on it. But we know that they're putting the new centrifuges in the town. So when they offer to even close a facility and people jump on it and say, wow, that's a big move, you got to understand the reality on the ground. How many facilities they have we don't know about. Is another factor. But the West is talking about taking all the enriched uranium out. That's Netanyahu's position. The West is saying, well, everything above a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we're not going to let anything out. we're not going to do it. And Khamenei, and like Khamenei, this was a fundamental principle for them. And the IRGC came out this week, the Iran Revolutionary Guard, which still is very influential, said we want no rapprochement with the U.S., so maybe they will be our biggest help in making sure that the West stands by the principles. But the message we keep sending of weakness, you know, Iran, aside from the nuclear program, when you want to know who we're dealing with, despite the charm offensive, since Rouhani took office, 250 people have been executed publicly, 560 this year. There are journalists, Christian leaders, Baha'i leaders, political activists, all sitting in jail. And they have a guy who they hung, who turns out survived, so they ordered that he be hung, killed again.
Right, I saw that.
But it just shows the brutality of this regime, its involvement with Hezbollah and in Syria, sabotaging every peace effort. This is not a regime that has changed. This is not a regime that has changed. They're buying time. That was the goal, and something that we said from day one about what this is really about is really just to buy time. They want to stall, and all the time they stall, they're putting in new centrifuges, upgrading it, moving ahead on weaponization. They clean up a site so that they can say, oh, this, you see, this story about weaponization was true, when everybody knows that what was going on in that site, you know, months ago, and why they barred anybody from coming out. And
give me a second. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 FM, around the world on the web at jmnam.org. You mentioned, I didn't mean to interrupt, I'll give you a chance to finish in a second, but you mentioned the French and British attitude. Merkel and Germany, the same thing? Are they consistent with the French and British on this?
Well, usually Europe moves as a whole. Merkel was the toughest on it. So far, she seems to be holding the line, but and Europe in general, I think, has somewhat. There is a lot of skepticism about it, but there's also a desire to break out. And the problem is that once there's a breach in the wall, I mean, we have seen how the Europeans collapse in the past, and even editorials in some of the major papers like Washington Post and others have finally have really put the challenge before us about what is really at stake. Iran hasn't changed. It did the same thing when Rouhani, and we talked about it, was the negotiator himself and talked about how they lied. He gave an interview in May saying that, emphasizing it, three weeks before his own election. So there's nothing that has changed, and so far, obviously, nothing has been given in, and stories are put out by the Iranians also to show that there's weakness in trying to split the West up, thinking that everybody thinks somebody else is going to be the first to break out.
So if not for the Geneva meeting, we probably wouldn't even have had this news story about what the White House might do, right? I mean, it was just the timing because the meeting took place, some piece of news had to be released.
I think that is probably true in terms of when, but not why.
Meaning that they still would have mulled over the possibility of rewarding Iran and made it public and that would have been it, no matter what the timing was.
I think yes, I do think that if Iran continues, or if Iran makes an offer that they think is or somebody will interpret as being worthwhile of discussion, then, and so far none of their proposals in reality are. And they keep adding caveats, and then you have, you know, one guy will say, well, we're prepared to meet. On the other hand, the other top officials will come out and say this is against what the supreme leader, the Ayatollah, wants. And he's the ultimate decision maker, not Rouhani, not Zarif, who knows how to play the game well. He's a chameleon. So we shouldn't be fooled by these rumors and what they say. Look at North Korea's model, then you'll understand what this is about.
I know, but the United States, if they deal with Iran the way they've dealt with North Korea, we're in big trouble.
That's why I'm saying look at the lesson.
Right. The best example out there. Prime Minister Netanyahu assured German Chancellor Angela Merkel Thursday that actual construction in the controversial E1 corridor between Jerusalem and Maale Adumim will not take place for years. Isn't this somewhat different than what the Prime Minister has said in the past?
Well, he hasn't said that E1 will be constructed. This is one of the most blatant examples of the hypocrisy. And you know, it's interesting in this regard. We talked about the UN before.
Right.
You know, Saudi Arabia was elected to the UN Security Council.
And rejected it.
And today they rejected it. And they said because you're ineffective and you do duplicitous.
Can you imagine that Saudi Arabia of all go ahead and make a statement like that?
And it's primarily about the failure on Syria, the failure to stand up to Assad, but it's also about Iran. And then, of course, they throw in the Israeli-Palestinian peace.
Right.
But it's a remarkable statement at this time about the nature of events and how people view how we are addressing all of these critical issues.
And by we, you mean the international community with the UN as its fulcrum, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The whole international community. And you know, so many challenges that go unanswered and the focus then is shifting without people realizing. I mean, you can have this regime that supports Hamas, Hezbollah,
right,
is reaching out now. Hamas is now trying to have a rapprochement with Iran, which broke with it over Syria because of their own internal needs. I mean, they're in a free fall, despite the fact that they can afford to spend all that money on building a 1.8-kilometer tunnel into Israel for a year and a half with 800 tons of concrete when they're complaining to the international community that Israel doesn't allow enough concrete in.
And by the way, according to the pictures, it was one sophisticated tunnel. It looked pretty good.
In addition to the 800 tons, there were 25,000 concrete slabs because the whole roof, everything, and you could bring brigades through it.
Unbelievable.
It's 22 meters deep. It's got telephone, electricity, two exits in Israel. Came up in a kibbutz in Israel right near a kindergarten. And Israel found another part of a big tunnel that they had exposed in November, and they believe that there are others that they have not yet detected and are obviously looking for.
How long does it take to build the tunnel with that magnitude?
It's a year and a half.
Wow. In 18 months, that could be constructed?
That's what they say.
Unbelievable. But back to the E1 for a second then. So he says this to Angela Merkel, and I think it's contrary to what he has said in the past, and you say he's just been very vague on the whole issue.
Well, the decision was only a zoning decision. It was never a decision about particular construction. This should have been built when Sharansky was in office. I think he was Minister of the Interior or of Housing, and he wanted to build there a police station and a dormitory for police, and they didn't do it. And there were international benefactors who were prepared to pay for it. And the area, people have to understand, this is the land bridge between Jerusalem and Maale Adumim.
Right.
This is a critical area where no Arab ever lived. Nobody lives there. Nobody developed it. Nobody cared about it until Israel wanted it. It breaks the encirclement of Jerusalem. And the fact that the world focuses this obsession with E1, when all of the other problems we're talking about, all the land grabs, all the things that people are doing around the world, and yet E1, this little nothing.
I know, but the prime minister, he encourages it with statements like, you know, I got to tell you, give me a minute to tell you about some of the backstory of Tuesday night's dinner, if you don't mind. Yeah. While you were very busy, obviously, let me tell you a couple of things that were going on. The it's obvious from the talk among the politically right-wing folks that there is a panic and a feeling that Bibi is about to really cave in when it comes to Judea and Samaria and topics like that. And if you read between the lines, was the quote that was constantly said to me, you see already hints to it. That's why this story to me this morning and his statement on E1 is a disturbing one when I was alerted to this by different people the other night. There's a great fear that he's moving in that direction. Do you think that there's something to be worried about?
Look, I don't think that Netanyahu is going to collapse on that, and there's no reason to believe that the talks are yet at the stage. But he has said clearly, he said he's prepared for a two-state solution. He's prepared for territorial concessions, but depends and set, I mean, hard demands on the other side, too. Second of all,
the question is if he'll wait for
what he really said. He just said, we're not going to do it now. And the rumors about, statements to different leaders are often put out by sources who really don't have firsthand exposure to it. So when I will call often about something that is said and say, well, what does this mean? And, you know, people are concerned. They will tell me that it was never said or was said, and what was said was a lot different. It may have said that there was no immediate plans yet for construction because there was nobody building anything there. I hope that eventually in E1 they were going to build the convention centers and hotels that would employ a lot of people from the region. Both Palestinians and Israelis work there like they do in Soda Stream, like they do in all of the communities in the West Bank. You know, tens of thousands of Palestinians found employment there. So, A, we've got to make sure that we know what he really said as opposed to what sometimes gets reported that they said. But I understand the concern because, well, in negotiations, you're going to hear, and you have Tzipi Livni and others who represent the government in these talks have made statements in various speeches that have given rise to concern about what the real intent. But I don't think that there's any decision right now on that.
What do you think of the, speaking of Jerusalem, what do you think of detaining, 10 people being detained on the Temple Mount this week?
It's obviously a very sensitive issue, and the idea that Jews can't pray, Jews are restricted, Jews are limited, raises a lot of ire. I mean, there are times when security situations demand that Israel take actions, but it's obviously, it's a lot of concern, but people have to realize, and the actions have to be consistent with what the longer-term claim, which means that we should be able to have a presence there all the time.
Is this unprecedented in history, Malcolm? You're a student of history, where a country and its government control an area, and yet it's their own people or those who are most closely associated as their own people who are restricted from going somewhere or behaving in a certain way somewhere while others can walk about freely and do whatever they want?
Good question. I think we would have to examine where it happened before, but I'm sure it did. But
ah, come on!
I just don't know where.
Exactly. You can't assume that it's actually happened before. The Jewish people are known for innovation. I think
one of the things, and it was an issue I discussed often with Omer after his comments, once you start compromising on the principle of Israeli sovereignty, and that does have nothing to do, we have to respect everybody's rights and religious rights, et cetera, et cetera. The other side doesn't respect our religious rights. They deny our rights. They deny our relationship to the place. You see it, the incitement that continues in the Palestinian Authority and the culture and the TV curriculum, everything. And we see the rise again of Tanzin from the Intifada period in some of the camps in the so-called refugee camps. There are no refugees there. So we're seeing old themes reemerge, but we have to be consistent if the world's going to understand why what our positions are and why they're inviolate. And if we want the world not to violate it, then we have to set real red lines. Netanyahu has always done this vis-a-vis Iran and other issues, but it has to be done regarding the internal issues.
Yeah.
Again, not to incite. We don't want the world now focused on Jerusalem. We want them to focus on Iran. We want them to focus on Syria and some of the other issues. And the negotiations are not at a point where any of this needs to be up front now. But everybody should realize that if they really do move ahead, at some point these issues are going to be front and center.
You know,
right now we should be rejoicing because Arafat's underwear was found not to have polonium poisoning.
Huh? So, in other words, he wasn't killed by
his underwear. I'm not going to say it was clean, but it didn't have any...
So, in other words, he wasn't killed by anybody is the point.
So now they're very disappointed, and while I'm joking a little bit, but realize how many accusations against Israel, polonium poisoning, and how quick so many media headlines, Israel accused of killing, when everybody knew. And I mean, the French doctors were the ones who treated him, and he didn't die in Israel. He didn't die in the Palestinian Authority. So a story like that doesn't get the coverage...
Yeah.
And puts the lie again to some of the accusations and ridiculous charges.
There's an election in Jerusalem this week, right?
Yeah, and you know that the PLO ordered that Arabs not participate again and boycott it.
So, therefore, anybody who's... Because who has the right to vote? Any Israeli citizen, even if they're Arab, right? They essentially would vote in the municipal election, correct?
Right.
If they're a Jerusalem resident.
Right.
And if they heed that call, they'll all just boycott it.
Well, most of them, yes.
Right. And after the special election on Wednesday, not that we didn't have it before, but I guess you would agree that the New Jersey senatorial delegation continues to be a really good one vis-a-vis Israel, correct?
Absolutely. Cory Booker, whom I know well, is a great friend of, and somebody who has a great association, a deep association with the Jewish community and with Judaism,
and the senior senator's
days at Oxford.
The senior senator here now, who's the senior senator, is pretty good as well, no?
Menendez,
yeah,
has been amazing. Actually, you saw, he even sent the message, and he planned to come. Menendez, chairman of the House Foreign the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he has been stalwart. He's led a lot of the efforts on Iran, and certainly on in support of Israel.
You know that the issue, I'm sure you remember very well the different eras in the last 40 years or so, maybe even more. Yeah, I guess since the founding of the state, it's been an issue. But there's been, you know, a couple of pockets of history where it's really become a hot issue. The issue is, who is a Jew? And there was an episode this week where, again, it looks like it's going to start to heat up again. The way things are right now, there's never, I mean, I know how hard it is to unify in these issues, but there's never going to be a consensus out of Israel on these issues. I assume it will always remain a problem, so to speak, and sometimes it will explode into big, publicity-driven episodes, and other times there'll be quiet times like it's been most recently, correct?
Exactly. And there are people who exploit some of these issues. These are very sensitive issues. It involves people's personal status, and understand why people feel strongly on it. But we have to have some standards, and we have to, at the same time, deal with them. I can tell you that I've had been involved in cases recently where I was asked to verify, or people had given my name to verify that they were in fact Jewish, and I knew the people's parents, grandparents. I mean, they were Jewish all the time, but they didn't have any documentation. And so, and of course, it was accepted. I know that recently there was a rejection of somebody from New York's recommendation regarding somebody. So each of these things then becomes a public dispute. Truth is that most cases are dealt with quickly and resolved, but it's always, these issues are always going to come up, and it's because of the diversity in our community and the diversity of views. And the fact is that you don't have even a consensus on one side of the issue.
Yeah, that's so true. Even each side is fractured.
Exactly.
I got to turn to you. And by the way, folks, I was thinking of this last night because people are complaining now every week how there's so many issues we don't get to. We've now started the 13th season of the Weekly Update. Malcolm and I had spoken many years before that as well. But 13th season of doing this on a consistent basis, or as consistent as this. And basically, I have given up on trying to get to my entire list every week. So we just now regard it. What is it?
Yes and no question.
We now regard it as one long conversation with a week in between for a break each time. So I'm going to be much more relaxed about what we do get to and what we don't get to. But I must ask you, before we run out of time, the theme, I was shocked how the theme of never again, and not just applicable to the Jewish world, but in general, was such a big theme at the gala this week. And if you could just give that message to our audience and just inspire us with how important our role is in Never Again, especially, or I should say even more so, when it comes to people from who are not within our community.
That's right, because I believe Never Again, and I spoke about it there, and other people raised it, as you said. It's not a hollow phrase. It's not something you yell at a rally. Never Again means that we learn the lesson of the past, that we learn from the mistakes of the 30s and 40s, and make sure we don't repeat it. And one of those is that the Jews have to stand up, and Jews have to have the capacity and the capability to affect their own fate, to affect the fate of other Jews. And I think the record on Russian Jews, Syrian Jews, Iranian Jews, Iraqi Jews, Yemeni Jews proves that we have learned it, but we have to sustain it, and most of all, teach it to our children. I was in a discussion recently in a forum, and the other person said something, and said, when I mentioned that the influence of the Holocaust because of my parents' experience, et cetera, and he said, oh, that's a negative. You know, that your generation is dealing with the Holocaust and its negatives, and the young people reject it. No, that's a mistake. In the same way, when I raised the question was raised to me about Iran at the end, he said, oh, that's another negative. I said, how in the 21st, in the year 2013, can you get together and not talk about Iran? How can you not talk about the Shoah if you learn the lessons? It's not to get lost in the Shoah. It's to make sure that the future generations don't pay the price again. And this is why Judaism puts the lesson on history, and why every parsha, Lech Lecha, why do you tell people where do you come from before you know where you're going? Because you got to know where your root is. You have to understand your place in history and to see it. So that Abraham is told, you choose life, not for you, but for all the generations to come, because the decisions you make affect all those generations. And you see how history, even if it doesn't repeat itself exactly, Iran is an incarnation of problems that we faced in the past. The fact that we try to appease Hitler, we try to appease Stalin, we appease all the time these dictators, and in the meantime, they have very clear, hard lines. They know exactly where they're headed. And we don't listen and take them seriously. We pay a price for it. You know, I was thinking this week about, after the dinner, about what Erdogan has been doing.
Right.
It was Erdogan who became the most popular leader. You know, America was supporting him and extolling him as the model, and much to the chagrin of many Arab leaders. Look what this guy has done just in this week. And he wanted U.S. military action. He felt betrayed that the U.S. didn't act on Syria, which I understand. Now he was the first to call for Assad's removal. He's still hell-bent on Assad's removal. But he fired on rebels near the rebel forces near his border.
Right, and then he always claimed to support them.
And he claims to support them. And now he's a little bit turned off because young Turks are going into fight with the jihadists, and they're going to come back. So he's caught on his own dilemma. He's internally cracking down and causing more and more crisis, and he has to focus on his own economic and other internal issues. And yet he can be extolled and can be told, oh, look, he has one foot as an Islamist, one foot in NATO. Do they ever learn? Listen to what the guy has been saying. First of all, a lot of people think he's mentally unbalanced. He certainly was sick. They tell us what they're going to do. And if you don't learn the lessons, if we don't stand up and have the courage of our convictions, it's what Moshe told Yoshua, a Jewish leader has to be. Chazak be'emat, you have to have strong convictions and the courage to act on them.
No,
and that doesn't always mean a public display. The fact that the Jewish community, and I mean this not as a personal thing or even for the conference, but that the array of people from around the world came and felt the need to be there because they respect the Jewish community. Maybe even some fear the Jewish community, but they respect it, and that the Jewish community today has what we didn't have 70 years ago. That's never again. I think it's a sacred pledge. And everybody has to think about what it is they can do to bring that pledge to reality, that everybody can make a difference. It's not everybody that stands on the stage, but everybody in the audience played a role too, just as they contributed to making the event a success. Every person in one way or another, contributing, participating, speaking, doing whatever they did, eating. But you have to think that every person has a role to play. And I hope that people will go to our website as soon as the video is up. Take an hour and a half, and watch the video and listen to Nachum's voice. But listen seriously to the messages and look at the videos, which were very creative, done by David Jassy, and really well done. And also the achdus that was present. There wasn't a person on the way out didn't mention about the atmosphere, the warmth, the magical things. But most of all, was the achdus. You don't know how many people step forward. I have a staff of 7. You think we could pull off an event, 1,200 people, all the complications? And you saw how complicated that program was and worked to a T, to a second.
It's already Friday. I'm hoping the program comes together at some point.
And it was just an amazing thing because friends of the IDF, UJ Fetish, everybody came with volunteers. People helped us. People came forward. Jay Buchsbaum, anybody in every respect made a contribution and said they want to be part of this thing and helped. The newspapers, the Jewish media, I mean, so many that we're indebted to, but did it wholeheartedly. I can't tell you. People called up and just said, I'm here, you tell me what you want, and it's done.
Yeah,
and
well,
it was done. And I think that puts the lie to a lot of the stories. You know, the Pew Report has gotten all this attention.
Yeah.
Beinart's ridiculous charges.
Right.
this was put the lie to it and tells us you got to hope there is there. You got to just develop the potential of our community.
I thought it was encouraging. The more we're told there's no future for the Jewish people, you know what usually ends up happening. That's when the Jewish people thrive. So,
right.
So thank God. All right, Malcolm, we'll speak next week. Big Yashar Koach and have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.